Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
What's up, everyone? It's Noah Daniels, and on this episode, it's just me hosting the episode, but I do have a really exciting guest. You know her as My Bloody Galentine, aka Becky, or I guess Becky, aka My Bloody Galentine. Yeah. Guess on your birth certificate. Well, actually, anyway, we don't need to get into that. I'm getting lost in the weeds. Becky, thank you so much for coming on the episode.
Thank you for having me again. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, and on this episode, we will be talking about Ed and Lorraine Warren. More specifically, you had an opportunity that is pretty rare to come by these days.
Yeah, they actually invited me into the home and museum, personal museum of Ed and Lorraine Warren with all the artifacts, which has been closed to the public for quite some time now.
And, you know, I was refreshing myself on the Warrens today before we did this episode. Obviously, I think most people at a very minimum know that the Conjuring movie universe is based on the Warrens. That's how I was introduced to them. I had forgotten, though, that Ed was a self-proclaimed demonologist, which I think is so interesting that so many of the people in the paranormal universe, I will ask, you know, like, hey, do you believe in demons? Do you believe in kind of the dark side of the spirits, which has also kind of been the fantastical side in movies and TV, right? And he dove headfirst into all of that. So I know obviously we'll go through all the experiences you had in the home, but something I am curious, when you were there, did you feel any bad vibes? I guess is the easiest way to ask the question.
So for me, a lot of it's going to be psychological because I've seen the films. I tried to consume as little as possible of the film content before going. Like, I've seen them, but I didn't need to be refreshed on it. When I pulled up to the house, it is nestled in the woods. The sun kind of just shines through the trees and you have that like beautiful like ray of sunshine going through the leaves, like that, like just ambience. And that it makes you feel like you're kind of in Snow White. Like, it's a very secluded, beautiful area in Connecticut, actually. When you enter the street, you're encountered by a sign that says, do not enter, museum closed, we will call the police. There's about a dozen of these signs when you go up. So that adds to the, oh, I'm not supposed to be here immediately. But when you pull up, it's just very peaceful. The gazebo is there that was featured in the Conjuring 3. So I'm feeling actually pretty warm and good. These are people of the same interests and hobbies and I guess profession for them that I share. So for me, I wasn't feeling that on the outside. When I entered the building, I definitely had a different change, but it wasn't like, I didn't feel like I was in danger at any point.
That's really interesting. Obviously, I have never been to that area. So I'm guessing, you know, with the popularity of the Warrens, they must have had instances where people were either trying to break in or, you know, sneak views of what's going on. When you got the invite to go and do this, did you ever imagine that an organization of that level would invite you in to see haunted or alleged haunted artifacts that the Warrens have collected?
So the first time you and I had spoke was shortly after my first time at the Conjuring House. So I had a bucket list of places that I'd love to go in New England and things that I wanted to see. And that was the off limits one. I had actually, when I first moved to Connecticut, drove past just to see, because sometimes you can drive past, you know, maybe get in or like run into someone, but it's not like that at all. It's very much like they, no entry at all. I never imagined being able to go in there because the people who are invited in, if you looked, are typically celebrities. Like there's a handful of celebrities that have gone, cast from the films have gone. It's very tight on who they let in. So I didn't expect to ever be going there, especially because the museum has become like such a significant part of pop culture history, not just paranormal history. Like once it hit the pop culture significance, it's like, this is no longer getting in the paranormal community. This is like the, you know, you really have to know someone to get in there, I feel like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess the big ticket item is Annabelle because of the movie that was based off of Annabelle. But before we jump into Annabelle, were there any other items that surprised you that you saw while you were there?
Oh boy. So there's, I guess, what beacon, like pivotal items in there, things that people are drawn to that they know the story of that aren't Annabelle, which leaves a lot for the Conjuring universe to have content to kind of go off of. So when you walk in, there's a sign that's like a little bit of a warning. They actually have a stained glass window with a cross on it. So that was like an interesting detail. It literally is like stepping into fantasy for a second, because it's like, wow, okay. So they really went all out with this. And as you walk in, you're greeted by the shadow doll. The shadow doll was created with the intent to curse people. So supposedly if you send a photo of her to someone, oh, and she's nasty too. She's got a human tooth in her mouth, made of paper mache, like these human looking eyes, and kind of just feathers from her shoulder with nails sticking out. She's very nasty looking. And if you send a photo of her with the name of the person you intend to curse on the back, allegedly, they'll become cursed, have nightmares where they kind of, the doll visits them, they'll haunt the nightmares or give them nightmares so scary that it could stop their heart. I'm not entirely sure of the origin, but that is the legend behind her. I don't believe that they kind of present that as fact. That's just kind of what the legend has transpired to be over the years. And looking at her, it's just like, in the case, it's like she looks back at you. So I joked and I was like, you know, Annabelle has a couple roommates, right? So that was one of them. Another really interesting one was the Devil Made Me Do It case from The Conjuring 3, where Arnie Cheyenne Johnson got involved in an altercation with his landlord and ended up essentially murdering him, and then, you know, and just serving 5 years in prison for that. Before the murder had occurred, one of the Glatzel brothers had been possessed. And during his possession, this toy dinosaur allegedly said, "You're all going to die." And it moved on its own volition across the floor. So that now has an Annabelle-esque case that one of the members of Nesper has put together. That's absolutely, it's a beautiful case, interesting history there. I'm kind of walking you through all of the very important guys. Yeah.
I have a question on the, because I didn't know that about the dinosaur. So that dinosaur was actually, man, it's really dark, but I mean, it's a part of the history of that murder then.
Yep.
Wow. What was that like to, because I know, you know, you're a bit of an empath and you've seen a lot, you've discovered a lot. Is it, I mean, you know, you're a mortician. So, I mean, death is nothing new for you, but was it unsettling at all to know that this object was alleged cornerstone for a murder?
I think along with many of the other artifacts in the museum, I don't feel that attachment to it as much as I feel the fear of the families or whoever had given up these items and maybe residual fear of people. I can't imagine being so afraid and like feeling something like that had occurred. But I didn't think much about that until I think there were other objects that felt a little bit more involved, because the murder had occurred at a kennel actually in Connecticut that is still in operation. And the dinosaur had happened in another household. So to me, thinking about that, I just don't know if I believe that the entity that ended up producing the murder was actually attached to that dinosaur, or if that was something that was projected by fear.
That's fascinating. Yeah. I'm trying to put myself being there as you walk us through this, and kind of going back to Ed's fascination with the dark side of, you know, the spirit realm. Even though we're just kind of in the antithesis of your story, you can really see what his interest led to and what was collected in that museum.
And, you know, a lot of people have reached out and had comments about the museum. And in my realm and the way I think of it, these people, they were taking things off the hands of people that they didn't want anymore. The validity, the investigation behind it, doesn't matter because they just said, okay, we'll take that from you and help you out. And that's all I really think about it in that case. And I don't know if the hauntings, if the curses, if the fear were only projected in the households of these people, or if, you know, some of that's still attached. It definitely is interesting. You know, when I walked in, I immediately was like, I feel like I'm going to throw up. But really? Again, you know, when I have a physiological symptom, I don't know if that's related to that, because I can't definitively say. We didn't investigate. They don't allow people really to investigate in there. So when I went in, I was just like, do you guys have an upset stomach or just me? And the whole place is dark. So one thing that did affect our interaction with the place is that we left the door open the entire time. When the door was closed, the place is just completely dark. Oh, you have kind of the red glow of the cross, stained glass cross beaming in. And I was like, I was coughing. Like I was standing in front of Annabelle. I'm like, like just trying to function. And I was like, I don't know what's going on. Like I need water. I was really struggling in there. So, but then, yeah, it's like meeting celebrities back to back. When you read the stories of these objects and they've been published online or on news articles and then seeing them in person, it's just kind of like, you know, one by one, it's like, oh, that's the dinosaur I read about. Oh, the shadow doll. And then you slowly kind of make your way around the corner and then there's Annabelle. So
it does build to Annabelle. You don't just walk right in and there's Annabelle.
No.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Well, so what, before you got to Annabelle, were there any other objects that stuck out to you?
Yeah. So another big one is, it's kind of interesting to bring it up this week because of the location that it was found, but there is an idol. So it's a carved statue with horns and these kind of deep blue eyes that was found by Ed Warren in the woods. It was obtained from Sandy Hook, for full transparency. And that's another one of the big objects that people kind of gravitate towards and has more of a legend or lore behind it. Now, as far as it actually causing any actions, I don't know. They describe it as a satanic worship idol. To me, I'm friends with people who practice Satanism. So the grounded side of me is going to say, I don't believe this was used in satanic worship. However, I can't identify what this object is. I don't know what it is. It's unusual. It doesn't look like anything I've ever seen before. Some of these objects, I'm like, how did they even encounter these? They do look like set up perfectly for film, and I don't think they were making them. So allegedly someone had been walking in the woods, a younger guy, and he saw it and it kind of startled him. And then the guy who allegedly worshiped this idol kind of came up behind him and was standing near him and creeping him out a little bit. And he was like, I got to tell Ed Warren about this. And then Ed went and retrieved the object. Some may use the word stole it, but
tomato, tomato, I guess. Since you visited the home and the museum, has it surprised you by anybody who's reached out to you since visiting?
I have heard from everyone in the world about this since I've been there. A lot of people who were shocked, people who had been there, who'd had experiences, people who have visited and had things they claimed happened to them after visiting. People who actually, someone was like, hey, my mom actually gave this artifact to the Warrens. And she's like, I don't know if it's still there. It was a necklace. And I thought, that's interesting because there is a necklace there that's a famed necklace, but I don't know if there are other necklaces involved. And that's the next object we kind of roll into is the pearl necklace. Now the lady had put on this pearl necklace and it's in a case and it started to choke her. And she couldn't pull it off. She couldn't, you know, get it to stop. She couldn't just unattach it. It just kept feeling tighter and tighter around her neck until they eventually had to rip it off. And that's how it ended up in the museum. And I'm thinking like, is this the person whose mom owned that pearl necklace that reached out? So that part has been really interesting. And seeing people who had been in the museum while they were still around, you know, you could still feel a presence of, you know, it's just as they left it, but nothing will ever be like them giving the tour themselves.
Sure.
So that was kind of interesting.
And out of those items that you've mentioned so far, is there one that you would want to see turned into the next Conjuring movie?
Oh boy. That's interesting. That's a good question. I love the Conjuring series, but I'm not crazy about Annabelle, I'll be honest. So I don't know if there's an object, probably the Shadow Doll, because when I had shared the story of that, a lot of people mentioned to me, I would love to see the Shadow Doll turned into a film, just because I think that's there for that. And, I think there's infinite resources that for them to continue making these films. I would love to see a film on the Smurl case where Ed and Lorraine encountered a succubus in Pennsylvania. So Pittston, Pennsylvania is where that case happened. So as far as the objects go, I think that it would require the timeline, like how the dinosaur actually didn't even appear in his respective film. So it's interesting to see how it plays out and what they pick and choose. The music box actually didn't exist. So that's really another interesting detail.
Oh,
so in the first Conjuring, you walk into this museum and you're expecting this beautiful music box and they're like, it doesn't exist. And it was just part of the film. So they did have the objects, but that wasn't one of them.
Oh, that's fascinating. Well, did they have many? So the Shadow Doll you mentioned, to me, that makes me think of like voodoo and cursing. Were there many objects like that that were used to hurt others, or were they primarily objects that hurt people that possess the objects, if that makes sense?
I would say it seemed like a lot of the objects involved in the museum seemed to just come from private homes. It didn't seem like a lot of those kind of things. There were tulpas, things that were intentionally haunted, where someone with bad intentions was like, I'm going to make something happen with this. So a lot of people had questions like, why are there Halloween decorations? Now, obviously, the Warrens were huge fans of Halloween, but at the same time, they were bringing in these objects simply because they liked them. So there's a lot of Ouija boards. There's about a dozen or so of those. There was a Teddy Ruxpin, a kitten I actually recognize. So to me, it almost felt more authentic that there are these branded items that you wouldn't expect. And again, the validity of the story doesn't matter to me. If someone gave them those objects in fear, I felt that that was interesting enough to comment on.
Do you know what set off the Warrens being such a multimedia hit? Was it Paramount or one of these companies kind of rediscovering their ventures? Or have they always been something that crosses the threshold of past people just like us who are into this world? Because, I mean, really everyday people tend to have some knowing of Ed and Lorraine Warren because of the Conjuring movies and other TV shows and stuff that have been based off of their work.
So the Warrens have always been in the spotlight because once they took the case of Amityville and that connection was made, they became superstars. And all of these famous movie cases, the Amityville Horror, we're going to look at the Haunting in Connecticut, a lot of these things that you've already seen, they were involved in some way. And then the Conjuring universe came, which was kind of Warner Brothers kind of going back and looking at these people. But since Amityville, there's photos of them. They were super involved in that case. Because a reporter that I actually ended up being on a documentary with, the reporter that made that connection brought them in, and that's when they kind of skyrocketed to fame. And, I think they spent a lot more time doing lectures. Like a lot of people talk about their fame, but they spent a lot of time at universities doing lectures, running the museum, and just generally being involved in the community in Connecticut.
Yeah, that's good to know. I mean, how many items would you say there are between the door and getting to the big event of seeing Annabelle in the display case?
There's got to be 500.
Really?
There's so many items. Many items. In the film, it just kind of seems like, probably 80 items or so.
Yeah.
But every shelf has something. And I went back to old videos of Lorraine speaking on the museum, and she said everything in this place has come from some place where someone was harmed or hurt in some way. So again, I don't know how documented it is for each of these items. Some of them have labels, some don't. And there's items high and low. There's some of the original paintings from Ed Warren. And then there's basically a wall of objects. There's idols, there's carved things, there's things from other countries. There's so many things. But there's, again, like I said, these kind of beacon items that people are gravitated towards because they know the story. So I don't know if like a neighbor's like, hey, I don't want this. They took it and kind of put it on the shelf and those stories are lost in translation. I had friends reaching out to me when I went saying like, hey, keep an eye out for the tiger pelt. Like the tiger pelt, like, how do you know about this specific story? So I didn't even know the story on that one. So, but it was there. It almost just looks like a movie set in a way. It's like, how do they have all these very specific items? Like someone could just do a painting and, you know, there's the tiger pelt and the pearl necklace and all of this stuff. I'd honestly like to see like a museum series come out.
Yeah, that would be really cool. So I am curious, what's the story behind the tiger pelt?
I genuinely don't know. Oh. My friend just mentioned it. I'm like, how do you even know that exists? So I'm not sure of the story. They didn't ask. So their son-in-law actually, before we went in, we were holy watered. So they bless you before you go in. A lot of people ask the question, like, how do you go into something that these places are, or these objects are considered allegedly dangerous, or she describes them as dangerous. And even Lorraine herself didn't like to look at Annabelle. But before we went in, they put holy water on our hands and we did the cross, which I don't personally practice that, but I'm in their house. So I'm going to go through and follow through with their beliefs and respect it the way that they've been doing, because it's obviously working for them. I have no reason to taunt, disrespect, or, you know, let curiosity get the best of me. There's just no reason for that. So the place is blessed periodically. They have a lot of maintenance that they do in order to keep it enclosed.
Probably better to be safe than sorry, right? Even, I mean, worst case, it's all fake and nothing happens, but God forbid, you know.
Right. Why would I need to like guess, you know? You know, because when someone tells you like, hey, I believe that I did this action and now it led to someone's death, I have no reason to test that.
And so as you're going through with the guides, are they letting you kind of ask questions about specific items, or are they pointing you to specific items and kind of giving you the rundown of that item?
So Ed and Lorraine's son-in-law, Tony, he's, you know, who's going to tell the story better than he is? He knows the museum like the back of his hands. So he gives the formal tour, shows everything, and again, draws you to the beacon items, and then kind of let us have free range to explore the place, which was really interesting, especially to be trusted in that way. Like, yeah. Okay, do what you need to do. Again, for the pop culture significance alone, like there really is a lot of iconic stuff that many, many people in the world have tried to own for themselves and haven't been able to. So being trusted to explore the place on my own was really cool. But hearing the stories from him, it's like, well, this is as close as I'm going to get to hearing these as organically as possible.
Right. Did he lit on or give any hedging to what his favorite items in the museum are?
He didn't really speak on that. Like I said, he covered the Devil Made Me Do It case, the shadow doll, the pearl necklace, all of those objects. And then he kind of spoke to the movie Annabelle, which is there. One of the Annabelle dolls that they actually featured in the film is in there, which I feel like is very appropriate, that it's kind of like almost like a trophy for their work. And he explained to me that he would love to get one of the music boxes used in the films in there as well, but there isn't one currently. I guess there were two of those created.
And before we jump to Annabelle, I would love to read just a little passage from Wikipedia that kind of explains the significance of Annabelle, because it was a good refresher for me, because it's been a minute since I've seen the movie. But basically it says, according to the Warrens, in the year 1968, two roommates claimed their Raggedy Ann doll was possessed by the spirit of a young girl named Annabelle Higgins. The Warrens took the doll, telling the roommates it was being manipulated by an inhuman presence, and put it on display at the family's museum. The legend of the doll is inspired by several films in the Conjuring universe and is a motif in many others. Can you kind of give us, I'm sure you remember, but kind of the more specific rundown that Tony gave you all of Annabelle while you were there?
Yep, absolutely. I had questions for him as well, because I had been looking into this so much. I live in Hartford, Connecticut, which is where Annabelle came from. So, you know, what celebrities from the town you live in? And I'm always like, Annabelle, you know, and I've been trying to
be
like
me.
No. And I'm like, oh, which one, you know? And so two nurses were working at Hartford Hospital. One of them received Annabelle as a gift. One of them had a fiance. Now the names they use are Angie and Donna for these people. I'm guessing those are pseudonyms. I've tried to kind of pinpoint as much specific factual information from this case as I can. I've been able to reduce it to an interview I found with Ed Warren that took place on VHS, where he says that Annabelle came about 4 blocks from Hartford Hospital. So they were working at Hartford Hospital and they lived about 4 blocks from there. That's the closest I've came because I wanted to find out which apartment complex she came from, because I'm curious where this entity came from. So they start having strange experiences. And at first, the first thing that had occurred, Annabelle allegedly was sitting at the table and she lifted her arms and placed them on the table. And they're like, that was kind of strange.
A little.
But they weren't fearful of her. It progressed into Annabelle writing them notes on parchment paper, which they didn't own parchment paper, and it was in crayons, and it said, "Help me, help us." This is the point where they call a medium, and they call the medium and they ask about the doll. The medium does a little bit of research and says there was an Annabelle Higgins killed in a crash. Just be nice to her, take care of her, and things will get better. But the more they were kind to Annabelle, the worse things got. So showing her love seemed to anger her. It eventually led to the fiance just being like, "I hate this doll." He had huge issues with it. And it ultimately, the pinnacle of the Annabelle story is that Annabelle crawled into bed with him, shimmied up his leg and suffocated or attempted to suffocate him. And he threw it off and was like, "Screw this doll," like completely done with that. So they involved the Warrens. The Warrens advised the girls that Annabelle actually was not Annabelle Higgins, but she did hold that name. It kind of stuck after that, but that's where the name Annabelle came from. They said it was a non-human spirit and malicious, and they were going to take it off their hands. They actually got this pastor from Hartford, and he did an exorcism on the doll. And I was even looking into that. I'm like, oh, this all fact checks. Like that pastor is, you know, still practicing. And I'm sure he doesn't want his name attached to that, but that definitely happened. And the Warrens took the back roads home, knowing that this doll meant harm. They wanted to be as careful as possible. So they take their car, they're taking the back roads home, and the car breaks down. Ed has holy water in his pocket because he always carried it in that jacket that you see in all the images. And he reached back and he dumped holy water on the doll. The car was able to start and they bring her back to the museum. All should be well at this point. However, one of the priests comes over and basically sees Annabelle, and Ed's like, "Don't touch anything." And he becomes overcome by the doll and says, "God is more powerful than the devil." And he throws the doll. This is before she's encased. Obviously, she's kind of free sitting on the shelf. And on his way back from the museum, I guess he gets a vision of Annabelle and he crashes his car into a truck. He totals his new car and he lives. But from that time period on, he would attend the Warren's lectures and kind of cover his face a little bit, like, "I don't want to see this doll anymore." One thing I did debunk is there are some podcasts out there that have talked about Annabelle having blood on her. What I believe that is she's a 70s rag doll. When that cotton gets wet, it kind of gets that like water ring. So I'm guessing that they assumed that that was blood and it just kind of got lost in lore. So I did ask the son-in-law and he said, no, there was never blood on Annabelle and there is not currently blood on Annabelle. So after the guy's accident, they encase Annabelle and they use holy water for the stain and they put some prayers on there and she's kind of hermetically sealed in a way. Now, this is where Annabelle kills someone, allegedly. So some museum goers go in and it's a boy and his girlfriend and they're walking around and they see the doll and then they get on their motorcycle and head out after they're done. He taunted the doll in person, which is one thing the Warrens always advocated for people not to do, is to taunt evil spirits or challenge them, which is also what happened in The Conjuring 3. Arnie kind of challenged the spirit to leave David Glatzel and enter him instead. So on the way home, they're kind of laughing at how ridiculous they thought the doll was. They veer off the road and he's killed in the accident. And the girlfriend is in the hospital for about a year. And then she contacts the Warrens and said, you know, Annabelle killed him. So, you know, I kind of take these things as face value, like this happened or this did not happen. I'm unaware of any records that definitively say that. It is a story that has been repeated for many years, but I can't say, hey, I found a newspaper article for that. But I did do a lot of deep dives into it.
You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey, I think that's the super difficult thing with a lot of these stories, and even getting to see the artifacts in person, is there's so much legend and lore built around the Warrens, especially at this time. I mean, so much time has passed. It's given lots of people, podcasts, TV, movies, you know, opportunities to really sensationalize what happened. But what I think is so cool is that you were selected as somebody who got to go in and see it for yourself. You know, you got to feel these things. You got not necessarily physically feel them, but, you know, you got to be in the presence of the items and see if you felt like something reached out to you, or, you know, and really explore that museum even on your own, which, like you said, that's kind of wild that they let people do that with all the stuff that's collected there. Mm-hmm. What would you say will be your greatest memory from visiting the museum?
I think even meeting Annabelle was, I can only put so much weight into haunted objects. Personally, I'm not a huge haunted object believer. I recently started delving into it, but I'm not super involved. Like with the haunted dolls that we see so much online, I'm a little more skeptical of. But again, the history. The most important or like powerful moment to me was walking into Ed Warren's office as he left it and seeing what that was like. Because it's like, this is what it would have looked like if I were doing this in the 70s and 80s. And I was seeing his reel to reels and his old tape decks that he didn't have like the digital recorders that we have, or laptops or apps or anything. And seeing his books, the typewriter that he wrote those books on, a house blessing booklet that a church had given Lorraine to review, and all of the copies of his books on the shelf, his paintings, the jacket he wears in so many of the iconic photos and on the investigations. It was just like, wow, this is so, if I felt something there, it was being in that office. And again, it's like, you could just imagine him going and sitting down. It's been kept that way. I actually got to see his last rites kit that he would use during some of these investigations. So his cross and all that. those things that were involved in that, that was really just like, whoa, that's crazy.
And I'm guessing they probably didn't let you handle any of those artifacts.
So you're not allowed to touch anything in the museum. Tony did open those objects and show them to us, so I was able to see it, but you're not allowed to touch anything at all in the museum, and I had no reason to touch it.
And how much videography were you, that you allowed to do while you were there?
So I had about 4 hours to myself in the museum. I actually had some friends kind of helping me out that I was like, hey, you want to, you know, have a weird Wednesday and go check out the Warren's Museum, because it's like, this is once in a lifetime. I'm going to take people I care about and let them see it too. And after we got the tour, we had about 4 hours to just kind of take everything in. 4 hours was not enough. I could spend a whole day there. So I explored the whole museum in its entirety. I went out back and I saw the gazebo that was dedicated to Lorraine Warren. It was a gift from Ed to her. And again, you know, you see that transpire in the films, but seeing it in person, it's like, wow, I can picture them being here and doing that. Like, this was all very real. And then just going into his office and spending some time in there and seeing, you know, the work that was behind it. Because I think seeing the office, I guess, makes it more believable, because he had to have an office. It wasn't just like, you know, we put all these things in here and we've turned it into a tourist trap. It's like he had to document these cases.
It made it seem like he actually was doing the legwork to facilitate all these, you know, haunted claims he was making.
Yep.
Have you, from any pictures or videos that you were able to take, have you seen anything spooky in there?
No, there was, when I first walked in, there's a video that I thought was so interesting, because as I walk in, somehow my shadow must have reflected. That's the only way I can explain it. My shadow must have reflected on the shadow doll, because as I walk in, the shadow walks towards me, which I didn't really understand how that was maintained. I only got a weird kind of vibe when I was taking a photo in front of Annabelle, but even then there's nothing really in the Annabelle photos. And then when I filmed Ed's office, this is so funny. I posted a video and all these people are like, nice job with the thing in the mirror at the end. You really nice touch with the mirror. And I'm like, what do you mean nice touch? And I'm looking, I'm like, what are these people seeing in the mirror? So I don't know. Some people think I saw something, but I didn't see anything. But I've watched it over and over. I'm like, do they think there's a face in the mirror? Like, what's going on with that?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, have you had any weird dreams or anything like that since you visited?
So I found myself thinking about Annabelle, and I'm not a huge Annabelle person. And I always see these people that are super into her and they buy the dolls and the replicas and they're talking about her all the time. And it's just like a huge horror icon for them. But after like the next few days after meeting her, I couldn't stop thinking about her. And the people are like, what are you thinking? I'm like, she's so cute. Like that I could think was like, Annabelle's just so cute. Like I want to get like a picture of her, print of her or something. And they're like, what? And I'm like, I don't know who I am, because you know, we've talked enough that, you know, I'm like pretty skeptical. I'm not a huge haunted object person. I definitely stay away from the more demonic or evil side of paranormal investigating. So for me to even care about Annabelle was just like, who have I become? And now that weeks have passed, I'm kind of past the Annabelle glow. But for a minute, I was like, I think I'm obsessed.
Well, now that you've, you know, ventured in, you know, right into the lair of the Warrens, would you be more interested in physically being present during a real exorcism?
No, I don't know. I think that would just be too much, because regardless of whether or not the person is experiencing something psychological or they're genuinely experiencing something paranormal, that emotion for me as someone who's sensitive, I can't witness someone in pain that way. I just don't know what I think of all that kind of stuff. And I've been on investigations where things have been heavy and emotional and felt dark. And I don't always give that weight to the paranormal. Sometimes I think it's just chemistry between the people or something else going on, but I just don't think I would want to be present for that, regardless of whether or not I believe the person was possessed by a demon or something, because you see those videos and things attached. Those people are in the darkest times of their life. And yeah. I don't know if I'll ever be emotionally, spiritually, or whatever, equipped to be present for that. It's not my realm. I'm not a demonologist. I'm not going to say anything about demonologists. I've encountered some really cool people involved in the field who have said, you know, in 40 years of whatever working in that, they've only encountered four demons. So I think it's very, very rare that that's truly what's going on. So just an interesting
It's
different side of the world.
In that field, you know, especially if you go to the most traditional parts of it with the Catholic Church, they don't really like to talk about exorcisms. And it's hard. I've reached out to even people that have broken away from the Catholic Church that claim they performed exorcisms. And it's hard to get a response from any of them. You know, they kind of just say, like, this is what I did, this is what happened. But they're really not, for most of them, they're not looking to gain exploits by publicizing, doing exorcisms, which I think is what fascinates me so much, just as somebody who loves to interview people and enjoys talking to, you know, psychics and mediums and all that stuff. I think somebody who themselves believe that they are taking a holy power and cleansing somebody of a demon, it just feels so much bigger than life and like fantasy, that I just want to really talk to somebody who's done it and that is like a believable, trustworthy person. I think that would be so fascinating.
Apparently, from speaking to some pretty guarded people in the field, true demonologists are like able to be counted on one hand. Because they have to be ordained in a very specific way. So there's a lot of people who I still call them demonologists, but they are not actually demonologists. There's what I consider the demonology crowd. So, you know, I kind of divide my paranormal universes up, and there's people who I think align with me. And then I would say there's people who, you know, kind of have beacons, mainly TV shows or influential figures that they look to for their information. And, you know, this is where I categorize the demonology crowd. And I'm friends with demonologists. I respect these demonologists. I'm not going to criticize their work or question anything about them, but I just can say that it's out of my wheelhouse. And I think that the people who are genuinely kind of involved with it, they're not talking about it publicly. Yeah. And they are truly trying to help people or do what they have faith in working for them.
I've talked about it before on the podcast, but I watched the series Evil not too long ago, and it again kind of reignited my fascination with, you know, people getting exorcisms. And I went down this TikTok and YouTube rabbit hole, and I mean, like you were saying, the audio alone of when you do find, you know, people that are claiming that, hey, this is a real exorcism, this is what it sounded like, it's horrifying. I mean, I don't know if it's real or not, but some of them a lot of people claim like, okay, yes, this one is allegedly a real exorcism. You know, there's one or two specifically. And the guttural sound that I would call them victims make, if it's not real, then they deserve an Oscar, or there's just some severe mental illness, because it's truly horrifying.
Right. And that's why I say, you know, that's not my business to watch. Now, say maybe 20 years from now, someone's like, you can help in this, that I have some magical thing that was given to me and I'm able to genuinely help the person who's suffering. Okay, I'll be there. I would do anything to help another person. But to just see it on the sidelines with no reason, I don't think that anyone needs to be spiritually exploited or their mental health or vulnerability being shown in that way.
Well, I mean, that's the tricky part about this field in general. You know, we try to be real careful with who we interview and episodes we post, because it's just, you know, it's a very niche topic. It's a sensitive topic. So you really have to try to be careful. But what if the reason they invited you to the museum is because they want you to be the next great investigator? You know, you're going to wake up one day and then the cross will be in the mail and then the notebook. And
I would send it right back. Thank you for having faith in me. But, you know, it's just the Catholic side of investigating. There's nothing wrong with it, but there's a lot of things that have gone sort of overlooked by looking at paranormal investigating with only one lens. Sure. And I often tell people this. My hairdresser was cutting my hair recently, and she said, "Do you believe in reincarnation?" Now, if I believe in reincarnation, what does that mean for all of the other things that I believe? But if I say I don't, then I'm talking to someone who is a practicing Buddhist and saying that I don't believe in that. So especially like you said, I was a mortician. I've worked with families who have practiced everything, monks. I've seen, you know, Hindu funerals and all of the ways that people approach the afterlife. And I'm trying to be better. I'm trying to decolonize ghost stories and stop attributing certain cultures for negative entities and bringing up the conversation that, hey, we can't blame indigenous practices for our hauntings all the time. We do need to do some legwork there. And the same with using people who were enslaved to be the content of ghost stories and opening them up to the public and saying, so-and-so did this and this dark history is involved. And it's not our place to sit here and blame marginalized communities. I think it contributes, it perpetuates racism. And I know that's a very niche topic, but it's something I'm very passionate about, that if we're using fear and attaching it to these things. So a lot of the Catholic side of investigating actually talks about, you know, like you said, like voodoo stuff, things that were involved in other cultures, rituals that they're not going to harm us. And the only thing I've really encountered in the field involving other cultures is when I see someone using something that doesn't belong to them. Like a lot of these houses, you have a white person with a dream catcher, or a white person using white sage, which has been requested by indigenous people to be left behind and not used. It creates what I consider like a spiritual muck. So maybe not negative energy, not negative energy, not demonic, nothing like that. But just this feeling of you're doing something that doesn't belong to you, and it's creating something that's not working for you. Mm. And it's just like this kind of residue. Yeah. And I've been through to a few public haunted places where I'm like, oh, this is happening because you're doing things that don't belong to you.
Yeah. Oh, that's definitely some good food for thought. Well, before we wrap up, is there anything else from your adventure that you'd like to share with the audience?
The last thing I guess I should say is that if anyone would like to meet these objects themselves, they are able to go to the Warrens Paracon at Mohegan Sun October 29th, which is hosted by Nesper. That's the foundation that the Warrens did host. So they'll be able to meet Annabelle for themselves. And a lot of people, the first thing they say is, if they're so dangerous and demonic, how are they moving them? But there have been a few viral videos out there. I don't know if you've seen them, but Nesper puts holy water on their hands and gloves before picking up Annabelle and moving her into her travel case. So she has a little travel carrier, like going to the vet or something.
Well, most importantly, if our fans for some reason have not followed you yet and are not following your content, which I know a lot of them are, how can they find all the awesome stuff that you've got going on?
Well, I'm still posting on My Bloody Galentine on TikTok and Instagram. I still haven't really taken off the YouTube other than sharing shorts there. And I recently started a project that's called Haunted Hotels Live that people are going to see from. It's a panel of other investigators who have a lot more experience than me that are going to be doing live sessions from haunted hotels, and we have a whole lineup with that involved. And I can't say anything else, but I can say that there are some things on the horizon that are going to be very big and different soon. So,
well, Becky, thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Becky, thank you so much for coming on another episode of the Real Hauntings podcast. It has been a joy to get to know you as a person and follow your experiences and kind of live vicariously through all the amazing haunted content that surrounds you. I think this is just the beginning of your story. I think the real great things are just, yet to come. So make sure to keep us in the loop, keep coming back and sharing with our fans. I know they always enjoy you coming on the podcast.
Of course. Yep. You're always the first person that I have to tell something exciting happened to.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, with that, I'm Noah Daniels.
And I'm Becky.
We can do it again. I just wanted to throw in your laugh and see what would happen.
You can't do me like that.
So with that, I'm Noah Daniels.
And I'm Becky, aka My Bloody Galentine.
Hello, dear stranger. I'd like to introduce you to something new. Or perhaps something very, very old. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine is a horror fantasy medical mystery following the titular monk turned traveling medical investigator. Follow Radolf as he navigates a nightmare world in which viruses are gods and the human race are not their favored children. steeped in history and an aesthetic that can only be described as a combination of occult academia and laboratory Judaica. The heresies of Radolf Burntwine have been described as Umberto Eco meets H.P. Lovecraft. For more information, check out the Patreon at thorb.info. But take care, dear stranger, for some truths are best left unknown.